Morning, everybody, on 88.1 WIPR. I'm Tom Hall. This is Maryland Morning. Today, a special edition of Maryland Morning. We'll spend the hour with Baltimore Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake. Within 5 months of the violence and uprising that ripped through the city in 2015, the mayor had announced that she would not seek another term. She gave as her reason at the time that she didn't want to be distracted by politics while she worked to rebuild the city after that cataclysmic event. What role will the Port Covington development play in those efforts? And have city officials properly vetted all aspects of this enormous project? Will Baltimore raise the minimum wage to $15? What's the status of the frayed relationship between police and communities of color? And what does the future hold for a young politician who's no stranger to the national spotlight? Nathan Sterner has the local news. Maryland Morning with the Mayor starts right after these headlines.
I'm producer Rob Sivak. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Morning, everybody. On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. My guest for this hour is the mayor of Baltimore, the Honorable Stephanie Rawlings Blake. Last week, she played a major role at the Democratic National Convention, gaveling it in on Monday and presiding over the historic roll call vote that culminated in Hillary Clinton's nomination on Tuesday. She continues to serve as the secretary of the DNC, having also served for a term as the president of the U.S. Conference of Mayors until June of this year. While her national profile continues to develop, she has plenty on her plate locally, including a controversial tax increment financing proposal to develop Port Covington and a stubborn violent crime rate. Police here and around the country continue to face challenges in dealing with communities of color, and those challenges didn't get any easier when State's Attorney Marilyn Mosby announced last week that she was dropping the charges in the trials of the officers involved in the arrest and death of Freddie Gray. If you live in Baltimore City, your water bill may be going up, and if you're working for minimum wage, your paycheck may be going up, too. Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake joins me in the studio. We're not taking calls this hour, but if you've got a question for the mayor, you're welcome to send us a tweet at Maryland Morning or drop us an email, mdmorning@wipr.org. Madam Mayor, always a pleasure. It's good to see you.
It's good to see you as well.
Welcome home.
Thank you.
First of all, before we get into a whole bunch of stuff that we have to talk about, tell us about the conditions over in Woodbury. Of course, we're all aware of this horrible flooding that took place in Ellicott City over the weekend. Two people died, a number of businesses severely damaged. But there was also some damage here in Baltimore City. Woodbury over there, it's in a really low-lying area. What's the scoop over there?
You know, when you take a look at what we saw with our neighbors in Howard County, I think it's hard to complain about the damage that we saw here in Baltimore. We were blessed to have minimal damage in comparison to what happened in Howard County, and significantly no loss of life. We know the places in Baltimore that are prone to flooding when we have heavy rains, whether it's around the water in Fells Point, over near the Whole Foods in Mount Washington. There are areas on, you know, if you live in these communities, you know this is going to be the area. This
been
is going
there,
to be
done
area.
That.
Right.
Yeah.
So it was a little more than normal, but nothing to the extent that the people in Howard County experienced. And we were blessed to miss that.
We were indeed. You're just back from the Democratic National Convention, a successful convention by all accounts. You were one of many Marylanders who had a very prominent role in the convention last week. Everybody knows that you gaveled it in. Everybody knows that you read the roll call for the historic vote. What was your role behind the scenes? How much time we got, huh?
You know, as a national officer, there was a lot going on last week. There was a lot going on in leadership. There was a lot going on between the two campaigns. I had a very, 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 very busy week behind the scenes. But I can say, as someone who loves the democratic process, someone who grew up, you know, I've been involved in and around campaigns since I was about 8 or 9 years old. It was an awesome, awesome experience to be a part of history at that level, to be a part of democratic politics at that level. I started going to the conventions in 92 with my dad. And, you know, to have an opportunity to think about how far I've come and how much his influence and encouragement has impacted me. It was just amazing.
Sure, your dad, Pete Rawlings, a beloved figure in Maryland politics for many years. But were you involved in the planning? You know, who spoke, what order?
No, kind
of stuff. I mean, who was orchestrating that? And was your role? You had a different role. Then.
Definitely a different role. The CEO of the convention, Reverend Leah Daughtry, did an absolutely amazing job with all of the convention logistics. She's been on the ground in Philly for the past, had been on the ground in Philadelphia for the past, I think it was 16 to 18 months, and it showed. It was a flawless production, and I think it reflected democratic values, and I think it really reflected what I believe is possible for the future of our country, a country of hope, of optimism, of inclusion, where we're not peddling hate and fear, but hope. And the notion that, you know, things aren't going to be easy, but you don't make them better by dividing our country. You make them better by working and becoming stronger together.
When did you actually find out that your role was going to be elevated? I mean, the emails came out over the weekend that were leaked by WikiLeaks, and then Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz agreed to resign. First, she was going to resign after the convention. Then all of a sudden, it was, you know, before the convention. She stayed in Philadelphia by all reports, but just had, you know, really it was didn't have any visible role, any public role. When did that all come down?
It came down shortly before it was time to gavel. I mean, not that much.
So Monday afternoon.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. So not a whole lot of prep time, huh?
No.
Jump up and do it. Yeah. Of course, you came back to Baltimore over the weekend, and plenty going on here. Let me play a clip for you of a couple of folks. This is first Marilyn Mosby making her announcement last week about the decision to dismiss the charges in the officers indicted in the arrest and death of Freddie Gray, and that'll be followed by a response from President Gene Ryan of the Fraternal Order of Police. First, here's State's Attorney Mosby.
Police investigating police, whether they're friends or merely their colleagues, was problematic.
That's right, that's right.
There was a reluctance and an obvious bias that was consistently exemplified not by the entire Baltimore Police Department, but by individuals within the Baltimore Police Department at every stage of the investigation. We've all bore witness to an inherent bias that is a direct result of when police themselves.
The comments made today about our officers by Ms. Mosby were outrageous and uncalled for and simply not true. The detectives assigned to the case conducted a very thorough investigation into the tragic death of Freddie Gray, but the state's attorney could not accept the evidence that was presented. She had her own agenda.
State's Attorney Marilyn Mosby, followed by a response to her comments last Wednesday by Fraternal Order of Police President Gene Ryan. Those are pretty strong words from the state's attorney. He's talking about inherent bias in the police department. What's your reaction to the tone and substance of Ms. Mosby's remarks?
I think as an attorney, I understand that we have a very, very high ethical and moral and professional standard. So to say that I was a little taken aback by the tone, I think that was a reaction, a sentiment that was shared by people that, particularly people in the legal community, that saw it locally and nationally. As the state's attorney, there is a requirement that there be even-handed, almost dispassionate administration of justice, that you participate not at an emotional level, but at a level that allows you to take a look at evidence and make decisions based on your expertise and experience and then be able to move forward. When you say things like inherent bias and don't have evidence, when you put forward cases and don't have sufficient evidence, it makes it difficult for people, particularly in the legal profession, to stand by that.
Over the weekend, Baltimore Sun had a story in which Ms. Mosby was floating the idea of changing the rules regarding a defendant's right to ask for a bench trial. She seemed to indicate that had these been jury trials, as was the case in Officer Porter's case, in which she had originally planned to retry, that somehow the results might have been different. And she felt that part of this unfair bias included the defendant's ability to choose a bench trial over a jury trial. What do you think of that idea?
I think implied in her comments is a criticism of Judge Williams that is unwarranted. He is beyond reproach when it comes to his ability to take a look at facts and mete out justice. He has found officers guilty, and he's found them not guilty. The challenge is when, I mean, as an attorney, you know, you sometimes you put on what you think is the best case possible. If you win some of those and you lose some of those, when you lose those cases, it doesn't mean that the system is wrong. It means that you've lost the case. And to suggest when you lose a case that there's some bias or there's some, you know, that there's that the judge did something wrong, when you have a judge of his standard and his reputation, I think it is playing fast and loose, and you know, it's borders on unprofessional when you take a look at the reputations side by side, because he is one of the most respected judges on the bench.
Have you talked to Marilyn Mosby?
No.
Do you plan to?
Yeah, we're both elected officials that serve our city. I have spoken to her at length about a number of things, and will continue to as we continue to serve the citizens of Baltimore.
Are you confident that the relationship between the state's attorney's office and the police department is, effective, good, getting better? Has it been severely damaged in this instance? What's your take on how they're getting along?
I think, you know, this isn't the lunchroom at girls' high school. You know, it's not about whether or not you like each other or get along. This is about being professional and doing your job. And I know that the state's attorney will continue to be professional and to do her job. The commissioner will do the same. And the men and women who have sworn to put their lives on the line to protect the city of Baltimore will continue to do the same.
My guest for the hour on this special edition of Maryland Morning is the mayor of Baltimore, Stephanie Rawlings Blake. I'm Tom Hall. We'll have more with the mayor after a break for the news on 88.1 WYPR. It's Maryland Morning. Stay with us.
If you want to join in on the conversation, go to our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, and make a comment. We'd love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. Again, that's at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
I hereby call the 47th Quadrennial Democratic National Convention to order.
I'm glad you're laughing. That's Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake last week in Philadelphia. The term of art for that pronouncement is gaveling in when Democratic National Committee Chair Debbie Wasserman Schultz resigned following the release of embarrassing emails. The DNC turned to Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake to preside over the proceedings. If you're just joining us for this special edition of Maryland Morning, I'm Tom Hall, and we are spending this hour with Mayor Rawlings Blake, who assumed office in February 2010 following the resignation of Sheila Dixon. She was elected for a full term in 2011. Last year, she announced she would not seek re-election. She'll leave office in December. Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake joins me in the studio. We're not taking calls this hour, but if you've got a question for the mayor, you're welcome to send us a tweet at Maryland Morning or drop us an email, mdmorning@wypr.org. So you are laughing at that funny moment. I thought it was a charming, wonderful moment. Tell what happened.
I mean, so I told you I was informed that I would be gaveling the meeting shortly before I was gaveling the meeting.
Right.
And given a flurry of briefings on, all right, this is what you do, this is what time we need you to do it, this is where we need you to be at this time, you know, like everything.
All this stage direction.
Right. Yeah, this is a stage direction. You walk out there, don't look at your feet, look out at the crowd, wave, soak it in. At no point did they say, and the gavel will be under, you know, the podium, so you can't see it. So when I'm walking out, I'm looking at everyone. And I get to the podium, I look down, I do what I'm supposed to do, and I look at the down, and there's no gavel. I'm like, well, dang, maybe it was just, you know, maybe they just, it's for, you know, for, I don't know, maybe it's just for a show, like, maybe it's like gaveling and, you know, I don't know. You know, I didn't know what was going on.
And then somebody pointed out it was like under a shelf or something.
It was under the shelf, which was fine, but for the fact that no one mentioned that. So I just figured, like, well, maybe they forgot the gavel. but I think it was funny because, you know, I think at home people are used to seeing me, you know, run in heels, but it was funny because I had to make a little sprint.
I thought you handled it in a charming and wonderful way. I mean,
what are you supposed to do?
Show business is show business.
The show goes on.
The show does go on. Turning to more serious matters, I understand that you called the mayor of Baton Rouge and the mayor of St. Paul, Minnesota, when the young African-American men were killed at the hands of police in those cities. What were those phone calls like? What did you say? What did they say to you?
Well, it was more than them. I mean, I'm still in leadership in the U.S. Conference of Mayors, and I take that role very, very seriously. It has been the most impactful professional organization that I've been a part of during my adult life. And I know what it meant to me to have mayors saying that they had my back, that they were praying for me, that anything that they could do, that they were there, and it didn't matter what it was. If it was just someone to just vent to or someone to get ideas from, I knew that they were there. And I thought it was important, you know, whether it was the mayor of Baton Rouge, the mayor of Dallas, the mayor of Orlando, I reached out to all of them because I know what it's like to deal with tragedy. I know what it's like to deal with something on the world stage. And there are not a lot of people in this country and in this world that have been where we have been.
Did folks call you in April 2015?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. There's a Justice Department investigation in the Baltimore Police Department. What's the status of that?
It is an ongoing investigation. I remain very, very proud because as we move forward, I have yet to see a mayor or an administration be as aggressive as I have and as Baltimore has with being cooperative with the investigation and pushing for progress. While the investigation has gone on, we have continued to do the work to reform the police department. And while you know, I think everybody and their mother and their brother want to take credit for the reforms that we're putting in place. My track record is very clear. Before the tragic death of Freddie Gray, I asked the Department of Justice to come in for the collaborative review so we could work to strengthen the relationship between the community and the police and reform the department. Before, you know, the death of Freddie Gray, I was in Annapolis in a very lonely fight to reform the Law Enforcement Officers' Bill of Rights. And it's interesting now, you know, post the tragedy and unrest, everyone is on board. They want to have work sessions and committees and, you know, joint sessions. And when I was down there trying to explain that the status quo was not acceptable and that we needed to make meaningful reforms if we wanted to rebuild trust between the community and the police, you know, the year before Freddie Gray's death, people were looking at me like, you know, I had three heads. And I just didn't know what I was talking about. Some of the most significant organizations down there that you would think would have been on board, one of them didn't even have a vote on whether or not to support the legislation.
Now, who's that?
The Legislative Black Caucus. Now, subsequently, everybody's on board. But what I know for a fact is that I have been very serious about reforming our police department. Baltimore City deserves to have the best police department in the country. We deserve to have increased transparency, professionalism, training, and collaboration between the community. And I know that I have a track record of working very hard to make that happen.
When this investigation was announced, you suggested hiring an outside law firm, and there was a kerfuffle about how much to pay them and what they were going to do, and it got resolved. Some folks said, you know, why did we need an outside law firm? What did we have to hide? I mean, wouldn't we want to just simply let the Justice Department, you know, have access to any records they needed and see what they say?
If you know nothing about a patterns and practice investigation, if you know nothing about how a city works through that, then it's understandable that you would say things, that you would think things like that. If you take a look at how these things happen around the country, and what happens during the process to make sure that it's a smooth process and that we are holding ourselves accountable to the highest standard, that we are learning from what other cities have gone through, and that we're putting ourselves in the best position to be able to be compliant with moving forward, every other city that's gone through this has hired outside counsel. So to suggest that by hiring outside counsel is because we want to hide something is just a sign of ignorance. You just don't understand the process. There's been in the Justice Department, I have yet to hear the Justice Department say that they have seen a mayor or an administration be as eager and as cooperative and as aggressive in working to support the investigation with information as well as push reforms as I have been.
What's different about the police budget this year than last year, following the violence and the unrest in April of 2015? Everybody said, you know, called for a lot of reforms in the police department. And as you said, you were one of the first people to start talking about that well before any of that happened. But what's different in terms of allocation of resources this time around than at the time that the unrest occurred?
And one of the things I can say that Commissioner Davis has been very focused on is getting a handle on overtime spending and working to have a more effective and efficient deployment of our resources. I also know that we've invested in training, working very hard to do the things that we know the community wants. There had been, before Commissioner Davis, no curriculum on how to walk a beat, walk patrol, yet everyone wanted it. There were no best practices. That's something that Commissioner Davis has been working to develop here in Baltimore.
Excuse me, that's reflected in the budget in what way?
Resources and training.
Mm-hmm. So there is more money in the police department now than there was in 2015.
There is a focus on it. If we're able to do it effectively and efficiently without a significant increase in funding, I'm going to applaud that, but I'm talking about the focus of the mm-hmm. focus, which is increase in training, improvement in consistent improvement in equipment. We're working to implement the body camera program, as you know. Those are the things that are new in this year's, I would say we should highlight in this year's budget as being a different focus than in years past.
Let's talk a little bit about the perception that folks around the country have of Baltimore. Here's a Republican candidate for president talking during his acceptance speech a week and a half ago.
In our nation's capitals, killings have risen by 50%. They're up nearly 60% in nearby Baltimore.
That's not factually accurate. They're actually down 7% this year.
But why would he care about being factually accurate now?
But there has been an uptick in certain cities, Baltimore being one of them, over the last few years. And one of the disquieting things to a lot of people, Commissioner Kevin Davis has noted that there's been a higher quantity of seizures of illegal weapons, mm-hmm. and the hope is that there would be a corollary reduction in violent crime. That has not seemed to happen. I mean, during the mayoral campaign, more than one candidate, they were even floating this number like 278, as if they had figured out there's 278 specific individuals who were dangerous and they were most likely armed. If we got those folks off the street, violence would be, considerably attenuated. But that doesn't seem to be happening. We're taking more illegal guns off the street, but we're not seeing the downtick in crime. What's your explanation for that?
I don't think that there's one explanation or one solution. We know that there are several factors that impact violent crime in our city. The proliferation and the access to illegal guns in Baltimore and throughout the country is a significant problem. The more illegal guns that you have on the street, the more dangerous our cities are. And that's why we've seen an increase in seizures, because we're focused on getting those illegal guns off the street. The reason why any of those candidates were talking about that number of people that are, we call them trigger puller lists, the dangerous repeat offenders. The reason why they know that number is because my administration is focused on identifying that group of violent, highly violent repeat offenders, and we're focused on them on a public safety front, on a public health front, and we are focused on working to get those individuals off the street and the individuals that they influence as well. This is ongoing work. It's not static. You can work really hard on it. And some years you can see an amazing amount of success. Under my administration, we'd seen the lowest number of homicides in decades and the second lowest number in decades. But you can understand that because crime isn't static, because violent crime is so pervasive in Baltimore and in so many of our countries, I mean cities around the country, you can work really hard and have varying amounts of success.
Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake is my guest this morning for Maryland Morning with the Mayor. I'm Tom Hall. It's Maryland Morning on 88.1 WIPR. Madam Mayor, let's talk about Port Covington and the tax increment financing plan of about $660 million that the city would float bonds to help that project along. I want to play a clip of Bishop Douglas Miles from Koinonia Baptist Church and Glenna Huber, who's the co-chair of BUILD, Baltimoreans United in Leadership Development. They're talking to Luke Broadwater of the Baltimore Suns about their concerns about Port Covington.
Why not take the time to fully vet this deal? Why not take the time to negotiate a real binding commitment on Sagamore that benefits all of Baltimore? Otherwise, 5 years from now, or 10 years from now, we're going to still be Freddie Gray's Baltimore.
The entire United States is looking at us to be an example. And we cannot mess it up. And fast-tracking that, this deal has the potential to be very, very costly for citizens who are already in some pain.
Has sufficient due diligence been done on this deal so far? It seems that Sagamore is quite interested in moving this along quickly. They're saying that they need it fast-tracked, that a delay would be damaging. They've got people to hire. They've got to get this show on the road. Councilman Stokes chaired a committee meeting. It was attended by more than 500 people last Wednesday. There are folks at BUILD and other folks who have really concerns that, you know, the estimates about what the thing's going to cost really aren't accurate. Where does this all stand in your mind?
I think we're at a time in Baltimore where the tide is turning. You see cranes in development, not just in downtown Baltimore, but out in the community. We've seen the most significant effort in my time in dealing with and eliminating blight in vacant homes through vacancy to value. And despite what some Republican candidates would say about Baltimore, people are voting with their feet, and millennials are moving to Baltimore in record numbers. We're one of the top destinations for millennials, one of the highest concentration millennials in the country, which speaks not just to where we are today, but where this next generation of Americans believes Baltimore will be in the future. And I'm going to do everything in my power while I'm mayor to take advantage of that. And Port Covington is an amazing opportunity for Baltimore. It's an amazing opportunity for job creation, for community building, to stabilize one of the fastest growing companies in the world with Under Armour, and to make sure that they continue to have a headquarters here. When cities around the country take a look at the pushback that that some in the community are giving to this development, they're salivating. They would love to have Under Armour invest billions in their community.
But and is any of that pushback legitimate in your mind? I mean, has this been
vetted
fully?
It's not up to me to say whether it's legitimate. They can feel how they want to feel. It doesn't change the fact. It has been vetted. It's been vetted by the Board of Finance, by the Department, by the Baltimore Development Corporation. It has been even vetted. The City Council has been able to hear and ask questions of the developers to the extent that they wanted to hear from the Baltimore development.
Well, for example, in Harbor Point, another development, just a couple of weeks ago, we had to triple the amount of money that we were going to float in bonds for that project because the estimate that was originally approved just turned out to be well short of what it actually cost. What's to say that's not going to happen in a development like Port Covington, which is, you know, exponentially more expensive?
But we're floating it in the same way, which means that what we're doing is providing a roadmap and a pathway using the tools that we have to encourage development. None of this development happens in challenged communities without public support. There's no place, there are many places around the country that will build infrastructure and hope that development will come. Baltimore is not one of those places. And if we think that we're going to get the type of transformational development that I want to see in Baltimore without using all of the tools in our toolbox, we're fooling ourselves. This is a project that has been vetted. This is a project that will bring jobs and resources and opportunities. And I'm proud of the work of the South Baltimore Six that came together, that took a look at this project, that said this is going to be a benefit to Baltimore and it's going to be a benefit to our community. And it's going to be so not because the ACLU negotiated a deal for us or Bill negotiated a deal for us, but because those communities who were directly impacted by Port Covington came to the table in their own name and with their own priorities and agenda and sat at the table and got their needs met. And I'm extremely proud of the way that those communities stepped up to the plate and developed a negotiated an agreement that will provide job opportunities and community development for decades to come.
All right, we'll talk more about Port Covington after we take another break for the news. My guest this morning, Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake, here on Maryland Morning. We will take a break for the news, and when we will return, more with Stephanie Rawlings-Blake. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us this morning. Stick around.
Is there an issue that you'd like to see us cover? Let us know. You can email us at mdmorning@wypr.org, or you can leave us a voicemail. Just call 410-881-3162. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. That's all at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, on with the show.
Over the past few months, as I've been making plans for what I know is a vigorous campaign, I realized that every moment that I spent planning for a campaign or a re-election was a time that I was taking away from my current responsibilities to the city that I love, and the city that I took an oath to serve. And because of that, I've made the decision not to seek re-election.
Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake on September 11, 2015, announcing she would not seek re-election. If you've just joined us, I'm Tom Hall. Stephanie Rawlings-Blake is with me in the studio for this special edition of Maryland Morning and the Mayor. That was a tough day for you, it seemed.
Sounded pretty strong to me.
No, I mean, you sounded strong, but I mean, this had to have been a very difficult decision. As you said, you know, you grew up in politics. Your dad, one of the most beloved figures in the history of Maryland politics. I mean, are you ready to wash your hands of politics when you leave office in December?
I don't think I ever suggested that I would be doing so.
We have a tweet here from a listener who wonders whether you're going to run for governor.
No, but I also never said I was going to wash my hands of politics. I made a very clear and conscious decision that I was choosing governing over campaigning, and I felt compelled to make that decision at that time because of what was going on in the city, and I don't regret the decision for a second. It was a difficult decision to come to, but I prayed for discernment. I prayed to make the right decision based on the commitments and the oath that I took, and I think that I reached that decision, and once I reached it, I was very comfortable with it and felt very strong about what it would allow me to do during a very, very ugly campaign season. And I think that it's proven, my decision day and day again has been proven to be the right decision for myself and for the city.
You want to be the chair of the Democratic National Committee?
No.
You don't? I mean, people have been floating your name along with some others, yeah. Mm-hmm. But that's not a job you're interested in?
No.
You have any indication? Can you give us any indication of what you're going to be doing come January?
No.
All right. If that's what you're going to tell me, then
what do you want me to tell you?
I want you to tell me what you're going to do.
Yeah, I'm sure.
You know.
No.
All right. That's your prerogative. We've got a couple of folks who've tweeted asking about the water bills. One person says, what's being done to address the outrageous minimum water bill for Baltimore City? Mm-hmm. Another person says, you know, basically the same thing. You're talking about raising the water rates. There's a proposal being considered at this juncture to pay for infrastructure. This follows, you know, a very large increase in the water rates just a few years ago.
So the water bills and the water billing, the water billing system, our water infrastructure is one of the major issues that I have tackled in my administration, issue that can have been kicked down the road for decades when it comes to water infrastructure. And when I became mayor, I did not sign up just for the easy stuff. I signed up to fix intractable problems. That's why I focused on the over $750 million structural budget deficit, an issue that had been around in our city for decades. That's why I focused on improving infrastructure and reforming the water bill system. It had been the issue of water bills. You know, it's funny, people have short memories, but you know, and I know that water bills and problems with water bills and tax sales related to water bills has been going on for decades. The difference is I did something about it. I upgraded the water infrastructure. I upgraded the water billing system. You're going to be able to get a monthly bill, so it won't take 3 or 4 months. If there's a spike in your bill because of a leak, it won't take 3 or 4 months of your bill going up for you to be able to see it. You're going to be able to track your water usage. We're going to be able to put the power in the hands of the customer to see exactly. You're going to be able to see exactly when you're using the water. When are you not using the water, and what that costs you, so you can make decisions about how you'll conserve water. But the price of water infrastructure is rising all over the country.
In 2002, the city signed a consent decree to fix these terrible sewage overflow problems. Mm-hmm. We've not met those deadlines that were imposed.
There's no city
in
the country has done it, and the reason why is because, and I've spoken out on this nationally, the EPA makes unfunded mandates for water for water and sewer infrastructure. It's in Baltimore and every place around the country. There are some cities that are considering, you know, basically throwing in their incorporation because they can't keep up with the pace of the cost of water infrastructure. That's not happening here in Baltimore. We're a national leader when it comes to how we're dealing with water infrastructure.
And will the changes this time around fix it? Will it get us even and get us the repairs that we need?
So if you don't know anything about water infrastructure and the EPA, you would think that there's a fix. This is an ongoing issue that will last for a very long time. We're an old city with old infrastructure, and there is not a fix. There is a managing of the cost and a managing in a way that has where we're able to mitigate the impact on the user. And that is my focus. We've been able to do that because I'm a national leader leader in the U.S. Conference of Mayors. We're the first city in the country to have an integrated plan where we've been able to take an active role in the implementation of the consent decree so we could get more bang for our buck and reduce the impact on the user. Because we've been able to do that doesn't mean we've eliminated the problem. It means that we're doing better than a lot of other jurisdictions. But this is a national problem. And the reason why I focused as president of the U.S. Conference of Mayors on infrastructure investment is to address things like this, not just in Baltimore, but nationally. If we do not find nationally a solution to infrastructure investment, you think these 33% that we're talking about now is going to be the end of it? No. There's some jurisdictions in I think Philly had an 80% increase. Not Philly, Chicago had an 80-some percent increase in water bills. This is not unusual. It's happening all over the country because of the way water infrastructure is funded, and that is solely on the back of the user, and that is with no consideration of the user's ability to pay by the EPA.
When we talk about infrastructure, let's go back to Port Covington for a second. There are folks who say, you know, if we're going to be greasing the wheel, helping these developers make these large, gigantic, you know, multi-billion-dollar projects, we have a lot of leverage in that situation, and we should be getting something from it. One of the issues is affordable housing. Sagamore has agreed, evidently, to a 10% goal to make the 10% of the houses affordable. Build and others are saying, why don't we make it a 20% requirement? Why not?
I think if you take a look at the agreements around Port Covington and Sagamore, we have solid agreements for workforce development, for affordable housing, for community development in and around the project. I'm very, very proud of the agreements that have been put in place, not just by my administration, but also the agreements that have been put in place by the community. And I know that as a result of this project, not only will we see a significant boost to Baltimore's economy, but we will see increase in affordable housing. We will see a further reduction of unemployment and more job opportunities for Baltimore residents. And that happens when you negotiate in reality and understand the economics of development and do so in a way that allows for significant development to move forward. That's how we were able to make the casino happen, and they were able to go above and beyond their hiring requirements. We've been able to, I was just at a park this over the weekend that was the funding for the community park, and the equipment was funded with the gap with money from the casino.
And of course,
these things don't happen without the development, and that's what I'm going to continue to push for.
All right, we are out of time this morning. I appreciate your time. Thanks for coming by.
And thank you.
We'll talk to you again.
Take care.
Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake, her last day in office is December 2nd. There'll be plenty of going on between now and then, and WYPR will stay on top of all of it here on Maryland Morning, on Midday, and with the WYPR news team. We'll come back with you on Wednesday morning, 9 o'clock. We're going to talk to Barry Glassman, the county executive from Harford County. It's part of our Focus on the County series. Until then, for Nathan Sterner and the entire Maryland Morning team, I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. Garrison Keillor's up next with the Writer's Almanac. Have a great day.